Let me start by thanking the organizers for inviting me here. When Paul and I discussed what I should speak about, he said, well, you have written that paper in 2004 on indirect inference, and I think this fits well with the morning, and he was completely right, I think. We all speak about this. But it turns out that my student Knut, with whom I've been working in this area about 5 or 6 years ago, in fact, he, after we wrote this paper, he disappeared. So he never finished his PhD. And he went to finance, so he's a very rich young man. That's good for him. But with him, also all the files disappeared. So I was a bit in trouble, but luckily I had kept the plastic of a lecture that I gave some time ago. So back to old-fashioned plastic transparencies is a little bit a challenge for me and possibly for you. Let's try if this still works. You all remember that they can fall on the floor and all mess up suddenly and things like this. We hope this doesn't happen. Indirect inference. We have heard this several times today, this term. How to do inference when the model generating the data is intractable. But the first question is, what is really intractable inference? What do we really mean here? So let me start with an example, and this will be the example I'll carry along during this lecture today, which is a simple queue. So imagine that we have a single server here, and an arrival process of clients. Assume, for example, that the service time is uniform in some interval theta 1, theta 2, and that the inter-arrival times are exponential with a rate theta 3. Everything is IID. We are interested in these three parameters, theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3, and the problem is completely trivial if we observe the inter-arrival times and the service times, when the service starts and when the service stops for every customer. The problem becomes more difficult if we don't observe the arrivals. This is called transactional data. There you have only data about the servicing time, when it begins and when it stops. But this is still feasible, and there are several papers on this. The problem becomes really interesting, at least in our context, when the data is only inter-departure times, when we only observe people that exit the system. So there I denote them Y1, Y2, Yn, and they're the time between people exit the bank, let's say. So this problem is more difficult. And we have, by the way, we forget Bayesian statistics now for a while. This is pure maximum likelihood, no MCMC. So it's a little bit a jump, but I'll come back to this in a while. To the Bayesian approach. Now. So data are inter-departure times, and we want to estimate all the parameters in the parametric process generating the arrival and the service times. And we assume that the inter-departure times is stationary, so everything is nice. Now, if we want to do maximum likelihood here, we probably write down the likelihood, and then we do some numerical optimization in three dimension, and to do numerical optimization, for sure we need to estimate, to evaluate the likelihood while we increase along the gradient, for example. So we have to evaluate the likelihood. My plan today is to touch these 4 points. Why is this difficult? How to do this with indirect inference? How to be efficient with indirect inference? And some discussion. I'll try to mention a few papers that have appeared in the literature in the last years that I think are relevant for our discussion. Now, why is this a difficult problem? Some formulas, but that's okay, I guess, here at the Newton Institute. Let's denote with Wn the inter-arrival times and with Un the service times. So then it is possible to write very clearly how the inter-departure times are. Now, if when the nth customer arrives on the queue, the service was busy, then the nth inter-departure time is just equal to the service time. So that's easy. While if the service was empty, was idle, then we have to also count how much time it has been idle since the n minus 1th arrival. And this is the formula. So here you see that yn, in fact, depends potentially back in time on all the history of the system. And hence, in principle, in general, it is not a Markovian process. It has full memory. This is a problem. Let's look to the likelihood. Well, we can, of course, write down the likelihood. The likelihood is some complicated integral, right? So we take our data, here they are, the inter-departure times. We condition on arrivals and service times. We multiply it with the density of the arrival and service variables and integrate out. So this is a 2n dimensional integral if we have n observation, capital N observation. This is maybe difficult, but not necessarily. But what is an important point is that this function here is really a deterministic function. Given all the history, I know how yn is. I know exactly the value of the nth inter-departure time. So in order to compute this likelihood, we have to really identify all possible combinations of arrivals and service times that are compatible with my data. And this can be done in a tree that connects to the trees of genomic history that we have seen before today. In a tree in this way. Let's assume, for example, that we start with an empty queue. Then, when the first customer arrives. But then when the second customer arrives, this is the value of the second inter-departure time if the service was busy, and here it is if the service was idle. So if under this condition we go here, under this condition we go here. And then we introduce the next arrival, the third, and so on. And it's a simple binary tree. Now every path from here down to the leaf here is a possible combination of equality and inequalities that, given the data, are solvable or not. If it is solvable, then they are one of the elements that I have to use in my integral. So, in general, we have to check them all, and there are 2 to the power n possible paths. So, we conjectured, and we still conjecture, despite Paul is trying to show something else sometimes, but I'll come back to that, that this problem is very difficult, and possibly NP-complete, so exponential in the dimension of the data. Now, on the other hand, it is very, very simple to simulate from that queue. A simple code in R or S+ in 5 lines does it, right? So how do we really understand this? Is it possible that we have a situation where it is easy to sample, but we cannot evaluate the likelihood? What does it really mean? So we can think in this way. When we say that we can sample the system, it means that there is some function G, some capital function G, complicated function, that depends on that we, if applied to some simple random variables, gives us the variables we want to simulate. So here, X is, for example, the inter-arrival and the service times. So it is easy to compute forward to produce new data, but in order to compute the likelihood, we need to invert this equation. We need to compute this set. The set of all x's such that g of yx is actually the data we have observed. And this is, in this case, and I guess in many other cases, the union of 2 to the power n sets, which makes the thing difficult. So how can we maximize a likelihood that we cannot evaluate in practice when n is equal to 10 or 20? So what do we do? An old paper that gives an answer to this problem that has been mentioned today, at least by Simon and possibly also by others, is that of Peter Riegel and Richard Grattan in 84, if I remember. They have, this is a very nice paper, and 30 years ago, almost, or 20. So what the idea is the following. Okay, you assume that you have IIE data, independent data. We don't have independent data. As I said, the data are in fact not even Markov. But assume for a second that the things are nice. Then the idea is to essentially produce a non-parametric estimate of the densities by simulation, and then maximize the non-parametric density estimator. So you fix the theta, your parameters, you sample the Q and produce S samples, Z. Then you use those samples to approximate the likelihood non-parametrically, given that theta, in a point Z, using, for example, some Gaussian kernels. Then the likelihood is approximated by evaluating those kernel density estimates in the data points. Then you take the log and you estimate and you maximize. You maximize at the end a mixture of Gaussians, for example. That's not very difficult. So this is a very simple idea, but the problem is that this idea does not work if the data are dependent. That's the main problem. So as soon as the data here are dependent, this doesn't work anymore. Also, there is a problem of bandwidth selection and so on. There's a few other problems. Good. Other methods that can do the job. Maybe MCMC. MCMC can be used also in maximum likelihood estimation, right? So if we have to maximize over theta the function f, the likelihood of some data yn, then we can rewrite this problem through conditioning by using hidden variables. So we can write we can instead maximize this expectation in a fixed point theta bar. So we fix a point theta bar, and then we consider some latent variables h. We augment the density with h and look to this ratio and condition the whole thing again on yn. So this can be done for a fixed value of theta bar, and then this has to be maximized over all theta. Now, this is sometimes a very useful approach, and in this case, for example, we would take h to be exactly the inter-arrival times and the service times. If you can do this, then if you can sample now the latent variable h conditioned on the data in the point theta bar, so it's only one point on given theta bar, then you can use this here as an approximation, and you can maximize this instead. The problem is that in our case we have no way to sample inter-arrival time and service times given the data. That's exactly our problem. So we are back to the start. And the trick of using augmenting auxiliary variables or hidden variables seems difficult here. Now, another approach is indirect inference. Indirect inference of Courriereau, it's very difficult to pronounce his name, Montfort and Renault. This is a paper of 95, I think. And it's a paper that has, I think, about 400 citations currently. So it's a very central paper in econometrics. When you read that paper, you understand, after some efforts, the method. But you also understand the context and the motivation behind introducing indirect inference that I will now tell you about in a minute. The point is that in econometrics, first let me say that all the examples that I mentioned in that paper, and in fact in many other papers in the econometrics literature that use indirect inference, all those examples seem to be absolutely feasible and easily feasible with the method I just mentioned you, introducing hidden variable and MCMC. So it is possible to use maximum likelihood estimation in all those cases. There is a paper of Christian Robert together with Montfort and Billio that shows this, in fact. So the reason is that the econometricians, they want to use standard software. That's the problem. They want to use SPSS or SAS or all the software that they use. And so they're very happy if they can use a simple model that is already implemented in the software to estimate things in their more complicated models. So they don't really need it, but it is a practical motivation in some sense behind them. So what is indirect inference for the likelihood of our data that depends on this parameter vector theta? It is five steps, and let me remind them to you. You start with an auxiliary model, or more generally, an estimating function, which I denote by Qn, of the data Yn, and depending on some other parameters, beta, the auxiliary parameters, beta. So this could be a simpler version of the likelihood, for example, as we heard today, a sort of pseudo-likelihood version in random fields, in the easing model. It can be, for example, that we assume that the data are IAD and use a marginal density for them as an approximation and then multiply. It's many different possibilities, and apparently they all work. So where is the magic here, right? So this is the point that I'll try to discuss. Also observe, as we heard many times today, that the dimension of this parameter beta can be very different from the dimension of the parameter theta. So here we had theta equal 3, but we could absolutely put up an auxiliary model with 5 parameters, or with only 2. Okay, so when we have this approximate auxiliary model, then the first thing we do is that we maximize it with respect to using the data. So it must be so easy that we can do this maximization. That is the requirement, a practical requirement for the approximate model. So here we maximize over beta, Qn of Yn beta. And let's denote by beta hat n, that is the beta that the data would have under the approximate model. And if the approximate model is good enough, I could stop here. And if beta would have the right interpretation, I could stop here. Now the next step is simulation. Now we fix a parameter theta in the true model and sample now the intra-departure times from IQ s times independently. So every time I sample here, this is the inter-departure times. In fact, I simulate n inter-departure times, the same length as the data. That's quite important, fact. And I repeat this s time, maybe 50 times, independently. Now I estimate the beta corresponding to these simulated data. For example, and I do it like this, I take the approximate model in the simulated data for each of the 50 ones, sum, for example, and maximize over beta. But there are a few other possibilities to do this. So this beta hat Sn of theta is the beta that I would get if the data would come from a model with theta. You have to say it yourself to really understand this, I think. And the next step is then that of the distance that we heard today. So now we repeat this simulation many times, and we try to find the theta for which this beta hat Sn is more similar to the beta of the data. And the way we do it is that we really minimize the distance between, we minimize over theta the distance, this distance here. Here it's beta n, the data beta, beta s n theta that comes from the simulation using a specific theta. And this here is some matrix that that describes distance. I'll come back a little bit on this omega n in a minute. So this is the method. Yes, there are immediately three small comments. First, it is important that the simulated data have the same dimension as the real data. And this is in some sense because you are comparing then the betas of these two data sets, and they should have the same finite sample bias in some sense. Then, of course, the big question is how to choose this QN, how to choose the auxiliary model, and finally, how to choose the distance matrix, or the matrix omega n. Turns out that this last point is not so crucial, at least in this context, because, as I will mention in a minute, at least asymptotically, it doesn't matter really what to use. So in the experiments I show you, we use the identity. This implies a slight loss of efficiency, but not dramatic, really. Let's look to a small example first. So this is a simple example just to show you how things can be. Assume that the data come from a chi-square distribution with a parameter degrees of freedom 3. And let's compare four auxiliary models, a gamma model with two parameters, the correct model, the chi-square model, a normal distribution with two parameters, and the exponential with one parameter. In all of these cases, we use the approximated model that simply makes a product of these marginals as the likelihood. Then we also do two other methods that have been proposed in this context, and that is to just match the means or to match the means of the logs. The reason why we do this is that in this case, this is in fact a sufficient statistics. So now we run an experiment, which is we produce 500 true data sets, all of length 100. And for several values of theta, we produce 50 replicates of these 50 samples of length 100, and we choose just the best on this theta by just gridding the theta. There is an issue of using the same random numbers so that you really see the effect of changing the theta and not of changing the random numbers here, which is important, has been mentioned before. This is what comes out. So here you see the estimated means. The truth is 3. This is the mean over the 500 repetitions. So this is the maximum likelihood. And here you see the standard deviation. So all the means are very similar. So all these methods are difficult to compare here. But if we look to the standard deviations, we see a few differences. We see that the gamma auxiliary model and the chi-square model and the last where we match the means of the logs, so the sufficient statistics, those three are the best and are similarly good. It's also interesting to observe that the normal, which had two parameters, while the true model had only one, is worse. So this is a case where it is not a good idea to increase the number of statistics or increase the numbers of parameters. It is better to maintain them as in the true model. Good. Now, very rapidly, we also understood that the question is really on finding good summary statistics. So let's simplify now the problem of how to choose a good auxiliary model into the problem how to choose a good summary statistics. So let's assume that we have a vector of summary statistics, Tn, of our data, maybe 3, for example, summary statistics. And now let's assume that really the estimating function depends on the data only through those statistics. So we choose the approximate model. It's a little bit what Wally asked the last in the last, at the end of the last lecture. We choose the approximate model to just use the statistics that we have chosen, and not more. Now, what? How should these statistics, summary statistics, be? How should they be? Now, we are going to compute those summary statistics in many, many simulated data sets, where we have varied theta, the parameters, and it is very important that these statistics is sensitive to changes of theta. If I change theta and I sample some z variables, and then these statistics doesn't change much, it will be very difficult to say something on theta based on that statistics. So it must depend on theta nicely. On the other hand, it should not depend really on the random variability of the z's. It should really depend only on theta and not so much on how the z's then vary. So one way to formalize these two requirements that say how should is to ask that the variance of the statistics should be small. Here it's variance with respect to the true model, huh? Should be small. And, for example, the derivative with respect to theta of the expectation of the statistics is large. So it changes very much in theta, doesn't change very much because of the random variability of the z's themselves. So when today we ask the question how to suggest summary statistics that capture the information in theta in some sense, this is a possible choice. Take the summary statistics that have a small variance and a large derivative of the expectation. Now, these two criteria also can be justified by asymptotic theory. And it is possible to show that theta hat Sn, the indirect inference estimator, using the matrix omega n in that makes the distance there, converges to the right thing nicely, and we get an expression of the limit covariance matrix W, and this expression simplifies very much if beta, theta, and Tn have the same dimensions. So if we have three variables in the true model, we keep three variables in the auxiliary models and also three statistics. And in that case, we see very nicely that it really depends inversely, minus one, on the derivative with respect to theta of the expectation of the statistics here and on the variance. So that's exactly what we said. So this says that those two criteria, at least asymptotically, are quite fundamental, or at least they are important at the first order. Here you see also that we can see also that at least asymptotically, it doesn't depend very much on the function f, but only on the statistics. If we would use sufficient statistics, then this here would become exactly the maximum likelihood part of the variance-covariance matrix. So we would see that this 1 plus 1 over s is what we pay in terms of loss of efficiency because we do simulation instead of maximizing directly. Yeah. So let's go back to the chi-square example. And let's compare three possible statistics for the parameter theta, the degrees of freedom, in terms of their variance and in terms of the derivative of the expectation, to learn how to use those two criteria in order to compare different statistics. So here are the three. The first one is just the mean. The second is the standard deviation. And this here is we take the mean of the logs and then the exponential of this. They are all three on the same scale, more or less. So now we suggest to use certain plots that help us to compare those things. those two criteria, to compare in terms of those two criteria the three statistics. So what we do is that we simply plot this function, this statistic, T1 as a function of theta, and try to see if the plot shows a variability in theta and not a big spread. So in fact, we sample maybe 50 curves, 50 times. So we get a plot like this. This was the thing that is only in plastic now. Here it is. So this is theta on the on this axis, and this is the statistics T1, and it's 50 repetitions. And you see that it is approximately linear in theta, so that's good. It changes in theta. And the spread is not dramatic, right? So, and now I use the old-fashioned magic of using... You all remember that we had all those transparencies that flip all, in all directions, yeah. Very precious one. So here it is, an experiment of this again. Yes? And you would see if somebody is nervous, right, immediately. So, for example, here you see by if you would observe a certain value for the statistics T, 3 in this case, you would invert this and be uncertain about all these theta values down there. It's quite concentrated. Now I show you the other two statistics. Here they are. So this is theta 2. It doesn't go up so rapidly. So this goes up maybe like the square root of theta only. So this seems a bit worse, right? And for example, if you repeat the same experiment here, you would be, for example, like this. You would be much more uncertain about theta because too big variance, right? Also. And it doesn't increase enough. And this is fine. This is probably linear up here. And this is the third one, which is also quite good. So we then also can compute exactly the estimate, the variance, and the derivative of the expectation. The derivative of the expectation, you have to do some averaging. But here are the numbers. And, for example, we see that T1 has the best derivative in terms of theta of the expectation. Also, T3 was quite good, but T2 is not so good. And in terms of variance, T3 is more concentrated than the others, so it's inherited less the variability of the simulation. So maybe all in all, probably we would suggest to use T3 as the best choice. So this is a way of comparing different summary statistics. Yes, so this has been produced today. This is the what we heard today, the ABC. I think ABC is indirect inference, in fact. So because what is the algorithm that has been, I mean, if I cast the simple ABC algorithms into a maximum likelihood context again, then I would say like this: for a given theta, we simulate from the true model, we compute some summary statistics, and then we compute the summary statistics for the data and compare. Now, if we go into the Bayesian world, we have to accept if the distance is smaller than epsilon and so on, but if we would stay in the maximum likelihood world, we would simply optimize, right? So this is completely feasible. Now, the difference seems to me is that apparently the indirect inference would not simulate only once, but 50 times. And hence produce a little bit more complicated, an average of these summary statistics to reduce, in some sense, the variability of the simulation in itself. But it's very similar in any case. So let's now go back to the Q example and try to answer the question, what statistics should we use there? What summary statistics are preferable in that context? So the data, I remind you, only into departure times. They look like this. For example, if I would have 100 of our general queue. So let's assume, for example, that the inter-arrival times are exponential and that the service times are uniform between theta 1 and theta 2, and exponential with a rate theta 3. So three parameters. So how do we choose good statistics? And this is what biologists in that context or others often can very well. They have good experience and feelings on what summarizes well the data. Well, for example, since we have to assume that the queue is not overcritical, that the growth would not explode, this essentially means that the expected service time is smaller than the expected inter-arrival time. Otherwise, this explodes. If this is the case, then the arrival is more or less equal to the departure process, because the queue, the service is occupied most of the time. Well, if this is the case, then we know that for the arrival process, the mean is sufficient for theta 3. So let's suggest the first summary statistics as the mean of the inter-departure times. We hope that this says something on theta 3, on the rate of the arrival. Then theta 1. The minimum inter-departure time is for sure larger than theta 1, the smaller service time. At least they have to be served theta 1 seconds, right? So the smallest inter-departure time should be a good statistic that tells me something on theta 1. Now, the upper boundary of the service time, theta 2, that's the difficult parameter here. It's much more difficult to find the good statistics for that, and I will show you two examples. Now, the first one looks complicated, but if I just summarize this transparency briefly, this is essentially doing pseudo-likelihood. So using a limited level of dependency in the process. There is an explicit formula for the first inter-departure time, which is given here. So it is possible to compute the distribution of a single inter-departure time and not the dependency of many. Well, then we can use this and just take the products over all pairs, right? So this is a likelihood approximation that doesn't really take into full account the dependency and is also probably wrong in the marginals. But this is something easy to maximize because we have an explicit formula. So we can maximize it with respect to beta 2, that is the parameter that was left. And let's call beta 2 hat ML the maximum likelihood, the parameter estimate that we obtain by maximizing this here. So now we have three parameters: the mean, the smallest value, and this value of obtained by numerical maximization. Now let's look to the plots. So let's take an example. Let's assume, for example, that the inter-arrival time has rate 1, and the service is between 0.3 and 0.9. 100 departures, 50 replicas every time we do the sampling. So the first thing we do is that we look to the first of the statistics, that is the mean, and we plot the mean as a function of the three parameters, theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3. For example, we do this by fixing two of them and leaving the other one moving. So here you see how the first statistics depends on theta 1, on theta 2, and theta 3. So it clearly shows, as we knew, in fact, that it has no information about theta 1 and theta 2, but knows something, understands something about theta 3. Then we look to the minimum. And here is what, yes, and then you could do this also. The minimum, Again, as a function of theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3. It has a good information about the lower value of the uniform distribution, and very little about nothing about the other two parameters. And then the last one, the beta 2 obtained by maximizing that approximate likelihood is this one. This is much more difficult. We see immediately that nothing is so clear as before, but this is a bit more dependent on theta 2, so we hope that it has some information about theta 2. If I would have produced instead then, for example, the median as a statistics, the median would have looked like this, with much larger variance than all the others I've shown you. So just by plotting these figures, you can learn a lot about the statistics. Good. So how would... Yes, then we have really also... I compare this approximate model with two others. One is by taking that pseudo-likelihood approximation and maximizing it really with respect to all three parameters, not only that one that I was missing. And here it is. And the third model is a black box model. We simply assume the auxiliary model to be a mixture of two normal with five parameters, mean, variance, and the mixing parameters. And now we can compare in this experiment where everything is known. We can compare things, and so here are the three models. Model A is using the mean, the smallest value and that maximum likelihood of the maximum pseudo-likelihood, only the whole maximum of the pseudo-likelihood and the mixture of the two normals. And by comparing results here, you learn that this model here is fine. These two first auxiliary models do pretty well, both of them. That it is much more difficult to estimate the right border of the uniform distribution, and that in fact in this case the mixture of the two normals is worse than the two others in terms of the uniform distribution, but is better than the other two to estimate the parameters of the arrival process. Now it really turns out that this experiment, which was using an exponential arrival time and a uniform service time, is not so difficult. Well, yes, it is difficult, but it can be solved exactly. So this is not an NP-complete problem in general. Because as Paul has shown in a paper a few years ago, is that exactly that model that I've shown you now, and also in another case, when the arrival process follows an Erlang distribution with two parameters, in both cases, he is able to compute exactly to evaluate exactly the likelihood without the need of any auxiliary model. And this he does with a very clever way of finding a Markov property, in some sense, in the data. So, sort of points where things restart, in some sense. And for the Erlang, this is more complicated because he has to condition on K and so on. But this allows us to compare indirect inference with exact maximum likelihood in this case. Turns out that for the two parameters that are easy to estimate, there is almost no difference. Indirect inference does well as maximum likelihood. But for the parameter that is difficult, maximum likelihood does better, in fact. And the difference here is not only due to the sampling, is due to the structure of the model. Good. I would like to finish by mentioning one further paper that has been published that I think is very interesting. This is a paper on robust methods, on robustification of indirect inference. And it is by Marc Genton and Helvetio Ronchetti. So they ask the question, what happens when the data do not really come from the true model I'm assuming? This also was mentioned before today. the true model that you're using to simulate the data is probably also wrong. The data don't really come from that. So what happens when the model that we are assuming is not really the model that is producing the data? We are going to use that model for simulation, but the data come from something else. The classical way of doing this in robust statistics is by using those contamination models, right? So they assume that the true model that has generated the data is a mixture of the model that you are thinking, that is the assumed model, plus another perturbation, where the weights is 1 minus epsilon and epsilon. Now, this paper shows two important things. The first one, through several examples, they show that this is a real problem. That a simple contamination, let's say of 5%, can make indirect inference totally useless. So even a small deviation from the assumed model can wipe out the improvement that is obtained by indirect inference with respect of using just the auxiliary model. You have the auxiliary model, you could just use that approximate model to do everything and stop there. Indirect inference is an improvement on it. It corrects for a bias, for example, and so on. But if the model is a contaminated model, you can lose, in fact, by doing that. Their example connects to models that we will hear later this week also. They, for example, take this case here. They assume that the assumed true model is a diffusion model of this type. Here you see there is a drift and so on. And this WT is a Brownian motion, so with mean zero, increments are zero mean and variance one. So this is the assumed model. But imagine that the data are really produced by an equation of this type, where the WT is a mixture of a Gaussian with variance 1 and a Gaussian with variance tau squared. Now, the auxiliary model is a crude Euler discretization of the equation, quite standard. And then they can compare in box plot, that I had no copy machine, so I carefully copied. So here is the box plot model here. So this is the truth here. This box here is using just the crude discretization to estimate mu and sigma. Those are the two parameters you're interested here. So you just use the crude discretization to estimate mu and sigma, and this is here how good this is. This big plot here is using indirect inference on top of it, so correcting the auxiliary model with the scheme that I reminded you. Now, in this case, the data were produced from the true model with a 5% contamination. And you see that the indirect inference doesn't work anymore well. It's not worth doing. The other thing that is, I think, very interesting in that paper is that it says how you can robustify, at least against those type of contaminations, right? And this is a very classical way of doing it through inference functions and so on. The idea is that you can robustify the estimates of beta in the auxiliary model. That's your only chance, right? So you have your auxiliary model, and there, so the crude discretization, and there you can robustify your estimates of mu and sigma, essentially by weighting according to the inverse inference function to throw away outliers in your simulated data. That makes sense, right? And if it does this, then robustified indirect inference is the best one again in this case. Good. I think I am coming to the end a bit before my time. So what have I summarized today? First, and this was important for us, are there really problems that require indirect inference? Are there really problems that require indirect inference that you can't do in any other way? And we think, yes, there are. And they are typically those binary trees problems that we have seen several today. Second is that indirect inference is possible and it works. We suggest that you can compare summary statistics by using a very simple plot and estimates of the variance of the statistics and the derivative of the expectation. We have heard how to make the ABC or this type of idea Bayesian, and also there are some thoughts on robustifying it. And I'll finish here.
So in this Q&A example, you had this nice intuition as to why you would choose two or three parameters, because each one was a good estimate of
something
of each of the three parameters you're interested in. But in lots of situations, it may be difficult to come up with. You know, there may be a number of parameters you're interested in, and it's quite difficult to come up with. You know, this one statistic would be a good estimate of this one, and this one would be a good estimate of the next one, and so on.
There's one approach that is called moment matching, I think, or something like this. I can't really remember. But there the idea is essentially to use moments of increasing orders as statistics. And you use simple statistics that are motivated by some expansion in some sense.
Right.
You think through the mathematics and hopefully that works. But on the other hand, very often, as we heard today, I mean, these models are models of biology or models in population dynamics. So the parameters have interpretations, right? The thetas mean something. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the theta means something, often it is possible to talk to the biologist and try to let them guess what summary of this data says something on that. It's not so impossible, I would say. But I like the idea that was mentioned today to start with a large collection. I mean, the other point is that it doesn't seem useful to use. In principle, it is not automatically useful to use many statistics, right? And there were several ideas that has been mentioned today to sort of start with many and then use some regression and shrinking in order to reduce to the most important ones. I think that is important.
Any other questions?
Have you ever thought about using, instead of one auxiliary models, but sort of like a populations or ensemble of the auxiliary models and combined inferences?
You
can use one models,
yeah.
One surrogate model. Just use multiple models or ensemble of such models and just improve the inference.
No, I have not thought of that. I thought this was a good idea. This is a good idea. So how to use various, if I think as to summary statistics representing the model in some sense, how to use different summary statistics and to combine the results obtained by them, it's an interesting question.
I mean, I just said that to remind me, you know, the machine learning, that's what I call, you combine the weak learners, is what I call the society of machines, and then when you combine this in a certain mixture, a certain way, then actually can perform much better than each individual, almost like two models.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of using one models, just use lots of long, simple, small models and combine them.
I mean, in the context of maximum likelihood, when you're really maximizing something at the end, you do a very simple learning. You do learning in these cases, which in Bayesian context is more difficult because you are maximizing all the time. So you start from a theta, your next theta goes up the gradient and so on, right? This helps in some sense. But instead of maximizing that quadratic function that I mentioned, you could penalize it. For example, in the way of ridge regression or lasso, you start to penalize on the number of the, on the number of summary statistics that you have, you trying to get only a few, only the most important ones. I think this is a good idea. I haven't seen that and I haven't tried that either.
Any other question? Yes.
In the queuing example, I still don't really understand how, or
why you can't just use a combination of ideas from MCMC and, say, the EM algorithm if you're trying to maximize the likelihood. So can't you just think of instantiating auxiliary variables representing, you know, if you only observe departure times, representing your arrival times, let's say, and then run something like a Metropolis sampler or something like that on those variables, and then just, you know, fix the random seed so you don't have a problem with that, and then optimize the likelihood in the EM algorithm. I mean, what would be the problem with that?
I mean, I don't know the answer. I mean, what we have done is that we have tried several intuitively reasonable hidden variables, and they all fail. They all lead to exponentially large problems.
Right, but, I mean,
but of course, formally, you would really need to prove an NP completeness theorem.
I mean,
that we haven't done. But Paul, do you have any comments more on this?
Well, in terms of NP complete, I think if you go from exponential Erlang arrival times to a general distribution, then it does become NP complete. So
it does. Okay.
Conjecture that it would.
So I think we conjecture that you can't find such hidden variables, but we don't go further in conjecture.
Is it that if you implemented an MCMC scheme, then one step of moving in that MCMC scheme would require solving an NP-complete problem because of the hard constraints?
Yes.
Is that the key?
But I mean, this is not really a hard statement. It might be that there is something clever here that we have seen.
Any other question?
This idea of choosing among statistics by maximizing gradient and minimizing variance is very appealing as a way of choosing between the choices you'd already thought of. And it seemed to be something that was missing from the other ABC talks today. but is there some way of going beyond that to actually use those ideas to generate statistics that you haven't already thought of? Some sort of projection pursuity idea?
I haven't thought of this, and today when I heard about that construction, I thought that maybe one could try. But in some sense, you want to put these two elements in the thing you optimize directly. So it should be possible somehow. So those function f that we have seen today in the regression should sort of be found such that these two things are optimized.
So the heuristic plots seems like a really good idea, but it seems like in the ABC talk so far, the simulations are coming from the prior over the parameter space rather than lots of simulations per point in the parameter space, which is what your plots
need. I think that is one difference, absolutely. I think that it should be useful to generate many d primes in the notation of Simon today for the same value of theta, and not only one, and summarize them and make the decision to accept or not based on that summary and not on only one. That seems natural, I would say.
The other problem I imagine would be the, if you've got many, several statistics that are informative about several parameters, then you've got a complicated function of the variance, and it would be hard to use in practice. But still,
That is a problem. So if you have many statistics that say the same thing on the same parameter, you have to get rid of some of them, otherwise you have problems. So
if you have several statistics that are informative about several different parameters,
yes. So the idea is to look one at a time here, in some sense. But that is maybe, No, I haven't thought of the multi-dimensional plots, really.
Mm. Maybe Arnoldo, a naive question. You are familiar with animal breeding problems. Imagine that in the context of the first example, the service time, waiting time, that the observations are clustered in some manner, and you are interested in the cluster effects in the random effect sense. How would you go about it in this particular context that you have described?
If the data you observe come in clusters,
random,
right?
Clusters. Imagine that the individuals are
at arrival, groups that are genetically related,
yeah. for instance.
Yeah, you could have an arrival that is a mixture of various, and so they come in groups when they come. There are several models. I mean, the Erlang, isn't it like this? The Erlang is exactly a distribution which is Poisson. Where the arrivals arrive in groups of k, right? And within
the
arrival.
Just have the interarrival times the sum of k exponential. So yes. It's less.
So that's exactly the model you want. So they, no, not exactly. I mean, this is a possible model. And they come in blocks, right? That's how I understand it.
And the interarrival is less, it's more uniform than an exponential, so it's probably not that.
Okay. But probably we can think to a model of that type.
Hmm. Any other question? No, so let's thank the speaker again.